Hey, good morning, church. Okay. So we're down to the short rows in the building upstairs. There's lots going on. Many of you have gone up and you see paint on the walls and all that. And I've had questions about, well, when do we move up? And we're not really sure yet. But just be praying and get excited about all that soon. So do be praying. So one of the most difficult pieces of living on a boat is the issue of sewage and plumbing. And you can imagine that, right? Most of us here, you go, oh yeah, that would make sense. Plumbing would be difficult on a boat. Well, you can doubly imagine that plumbing in a submarine would have to be exponentially harder. And guess what? It is. And this has actually been one of the big bugaboos of submarine warfare for years. First of all, how do you keep plumbing quiet? And then, of course, how do you get the water to go in the right direction, considering you're surrounded by water, which is pressurized? Right? And so some of those systems that were developed actually use the same technology they use for torpedoes to have a high-pressure ejection of sewage. Which I've always kind of wondered about. You know, I don't know how, as much as people are concerned about the environment, it's kind of weird that you would just eject raw sewage out into the ocean and hope for the best. But this, to this day, is one of the hardest pieces of submarines. How do you deal with plumbing? And so in World War II, you can imagine it's much more difficult. And actually, this is where the U.S. and the Germans really differ U.S. sort of approach towards dealing with stuff, crew welfare and comfort were almost as high a priority as other things. For the Germans, it was completely upside down. Crew comfort and welfare was way down on the list. And so they used very primitive plumbing systems and sometimes just buckets. And so, you know, you deal with that. You hope at some point you get to go to the surface and empty all the buckets. They said actually the worst job in Germany during World War II was to be a dock worker on a German U-boat site, because when the boats would come in from being on patrol for weeks, you can imagine how bad it was. They said dock workers would literally lose their lunch when they opened all the hatches and the diesel and the body odor and everything else came spewing out of those submarines. Well, so as I said, they investigated different technologies. And one of those was on a new iteration of the U-7 series, and it was boat number 1206. And people know in history the history of U-1206 because it was the one U-boat sunk in World War II that was sunk by its own toilet. What happened was they were on maneuvers off the coast of Scotland, and one of the officers went to use the restroom without consulting the technician who was in charge of the toilet. Yes, there was a guy in charge of the use of the toilet, and considering that there was only one toilet on that boat for 50 men, you had to have somebody who's very skilled in the use of that toilet. So the officer just didn't think anything of it, and he accidentally, instead of flushing the sewage out, let the ocean in. The ocean came in through a toilet. You imagine how fast that must have been. And so as the boat began to fill up with the ocean, the salt water leaked over onto the batteries. The batteries began to emit chlorine gas. The boat filled up with chlorine gas. They rose to the surface as quickly as possible to keep from being killed by the chlorine gas, only to find that Allied planes were in the area, spotted them, and began to attack them. Three crewmen were killed. Eventually, they flooded the boat, scuttled it, and everybody floated to the shore with three or four crewmen killed in the incident, all because an officer went to the bathroom. It's a fragile world living under the ocean, isn't it? You ever have those moments where everything goes wrong like that? Right? Well, in a sense, a church is that way. And you think, I see a lot of similarities between submarines and people, and I see a lot of similarities between submarines and churches. Because you really are. You're you're living in a pressurized environment. Everybody has to work together. Things can go horribly wrong. And you're faced with two issues. One is the internal dynamics of a group of people all trying to get along, surrounded by a common cause and a common belief system. But you're also dealing with outside pressures of people who really have no good intended for you. And understand that. That if this church ever failed, if it ever goes down the tubes, if it ever has a major catastrophe, there will be people in the community who will go, huzzah. And you think, are people that petty? You bet they are. You bet they are. It's the way people are. We're constructed that when our enemies or those we perceive as enemies fail, we gain a great deal of joy out of that. And the other is that jealousy or pride or just a sense of a thing that happens outside of people's control sometimes causes them to hate a thing. It's just the way it is. And so I've been pastor here going on 14 years, and I had this great moment in my evaluation this year where a couple of the elders said, hey, we're just thankful that after all these years, there's not a sense that you're just phoning it in or you're not working very hard and you're just sort of counting on past performance to get you through. I was encouraged by that because I got to tell you, when you use as many words as I use, you're going to make some mistakes, right? If you talk as much as I have to talk in a week's basis, you're going to say some stupid things. You're going to do some stupid things. You're going to get it wrong, right? And that's the way it is. And so a lot of you know that. So you use as few words as possible in life. And God bless you. There's a certain wisdom in that. And so the last thing I want to do is that my performance or a thing that I do or a thing that I don't do would cause some sort of failure in this system, sort of let the ocean in, right? Sort of cause a major catastrophe. And that happens. It really does. Churches are fragile little worlds. In a sense, they are as strong as the sovereignty and the power of God. And in a sense, they're as fragile as Christmas ornaments, which many of you will leave up for the next several months until you get the gumption to take them down. In a sense, it is. A church is a very fragile and it's a very strong thing. But boy, it can go sideways. And so what we have in Timothy, and it's all the way through, the book of Timothy is to a pastor about how church ought to work. And part of that is to deal with sort of the internal plumbing of it. Hey, this is the way your elders work, and this is the way your deacons work, and this is the role of women, and this is the shape of church. This is how the system works. This valve has to be closed before this valve opens. This has to be done procedurally this way. That's part of the math here. It's part of the deal. And so we pick up here dealing with verse 17 of chapter 5 today, 17 through 25, and it really deals with just an extension of the plumbing issues of how church works, how you cause the little world with inside that building to work, because two things are going on. One is we have to battle the external pressures and the external attacks that come upon this little world of ours, this fragile little world called church. But part of what we do is making sure that what happens inside the place works the way it ought. Works the way it ought. And that's why I encourage you guys, as you young people, as you go away to school or you move out of the area, that you find a church where it works properly. Where you don't find a church that's just focused around a pastor, but there's this multiplicity of leadership. There's an elder board, a functional board. Because in that multiplicity of counsel, there's wisdom. In that multiplicity of function, there's safety. There's good stuff that happens in places like that. And so we have that sort of going on. That being said, there's also an internal dynamic of the way, even within the elders, from the beginning, this is the way it works. And so we pick up in verse 17. The elders who rule well, or actually a couple of versions you will find, if you have an NIV, you'll have something that says who are in charge of the affairs of the church, or elders who have a greater influence over the affairs of the church. Or, as my translation here says, who rule well are to be considered worthy of double honor, especially of those who work hard at preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle the ox while he's threshing, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. Do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses, and those who continue in sin, you rebuke those in the presence of all so that the rest will be fearful of sinning. And so here he talks about the internal workings of eldership or an elder board. And there seem to be two classifications of elders. One is occupational eldership and the other is vocational eldership. I happen to be a vocational elder. And so what Scripture has here, and this is not something made up in modern times or a part of an idealized future for the church, but rather it's the way the church has functioned for a long time, is that those who are vocational in the eldership ought to get paid for it. Now, that's an amazing thing for Paul to talk about, because there is this diversity of eldership that, in a sense, elders are pastors, and we talk about that all the time, right? I am not the chief elder. I'm not the ruler of the church. I'm not the boss. I'm not the CEO, and churches that function that way are inherently weak. If you want to talk about a church that will fall apart very, very quickly, find a church that is focused in and around the elder. I told you about that a long time ago, that there was this one church website I was on, and the church website said, we believe that the pastor is a unique voice of God to our congregation, and he is the final arbiter in all matters spiritual and financial. And I thought, you talk about giving a gun to a monkey. That's a tough place to be. You know? Because there's that rule. Giving a gun to a monkey, right? You're not sure what's going to happen when you give a gun to a monkey, but you know it's probably not good. Right? And that's true. If you make your pastor the final arbiter of all matters, financial as well as spiritual, you're just handing a gun to a monkey. You don't know what's going to happen, but odds are not going to be good. Not going to be good. And so there's this multiplicity of elders. But what's interesting is, even at this point, even in Paul's day, as he's talking about the way church functions, there's this two classification. One are occupational elders, the other is vocational. I'm the vocational guy. But vocational does not mean higher. It just means I get paid to do the work because I have a primary responsibility over the day-to-day affairs of the church, and I am hopefully working hard at preaching and teaching. That for the case of preaching and teaching, I might set aside that time so that I'm not working some other job. And folks, this is a thing. This is a thing. And so there are two issues that have plagued the church through church history. And it's just bizarre, but you kind of understand as people deal with stuff, they're trying to deal with facts on the ground and they're trying to deal with real situations. And how do they do that? Well, most people don't keep those issues separated properly. And they're trying to correct one problem using another mechanism. And it's just the strange thing that happens. And so the issue came in as the church grew up. How do we maintain control over doctrine and practice as well as the preaching or the pulpit of the church? And so fairly early on, the church became divided between that which was vocational and that which was professional, occupational, right? It became a division of that which is the laity and that which is the clergy. And the goal was is that the clergy, or what's sometimes termed the magisterium, that the magisterium would keep control over the belief system of the church. And this led to the arise of a priesthood within the church. But that's not the way it's supposed to work. See, they were dealing with real problems. How do you control doctrine? How do you control doctrine? And so the idea, well, let's make a special class of people who have authority over doctrine. We'll call those the priesthood. The problem is that you're dealing with the wrong mechanism. Because inside Christianity, who are priests? All of us. Every one of you in this room who names the name of Christ and is saved by grace, every one of you is a priest. And so what happened is, well, we're going to create a special kind of priestly office. And these are the guys who will control the doctrine of the church, the pulpit. They'll control understanding of Scripture. And what happened is they used a wrong mechanism to fix a problem. Rather than having a multiplicity of elders, both vocational and occupational, standing as bulwarks to sound doctrine, they created sort of a special group. And they called it the priesthood. And what it did was it ultimately detracted from a priesthood that each one of you has. And that's an amazing thought. That each one of you is a priest of God. That each one of you can go boldly before the throne of grace. That each one of you, because of Christ's sacrifice, belongs in the presence of God. Folks, don't ever give that up. And don't ever think of that as no big deal. Do you realize that when Jesus said, "It is finished" on the cross, that he purchased your ticket into the very of Holy, Holy, Holy of Holies, which is why the veil of the temple was rent? You actually belong now in the presence of God. You can actually stand in the presence of God as a believer. That's an amazing thing. And so what they did by sort of creating that polity, or it's where we get the word politics, it's the way church functions, the fragile little world of church. What they did by creating that sort of polity was they destroyed sound teaching about who you are as a believer. That's a terrible thing. But it's a thing that happens. And so Paul here, he's writing to instruct. He says, look, some of your elders are going to teach and preach full time. They're going to be people who have an oversight in the day-to-day sense of the word for the church. These guys ought to be paid for what they do. Don't muzzle that ox while he's threshing. Keep him fed. Keep him provided so that he can take the time to spend on your people. That does not mean I'm a higher elder or a better elder than any other elder on the elder board. First of all of us in this room who know Jesus are priests to our God. Second of all, everybody in leadership has taken and made a decision to take responsibility for this church. I am not the final arbiter of all matters spiritual and financial, nor should I be, as much as if I were offered the position, I might be tempted. Right? But that's not the way it ought to work. And so Paul here says, this is the way it works. You pay this guy. However, also understand, being in leadership comes with responsibility, but it also comes with real danger, right? And I talked a little bit about that. I hope that nothing I ever do floods the ship and destroys it. Don't you know that officer on that ship felt bad? He went to use the toilet and four people got killed. That's a bad day. You may burn the meatloaf. You may blow the engine on the car, but you've never had a day where your tiny mistake meant that big a deal. That's a bad, bad day. I just went to flush the toilet and I flushed the ship. That's a terrible moment. And pastors and elders have done that. They have done that. Church history is filled up with people who just made dumb decisions, who fell into sin, or they went a direction that was ultimately ruinous, or they tried to fix a problem using the wrong mechanism, and they destroyed a thing. They destroyed a thing. That happens. And I hope I'm never the cause of that. And the thing is, I know that I am potentially the cause of that because I speak in this pulpit. And I use a lot of words. And I deal with a lot of people. And I don't think a day goes by where I'm not just somewhat aware of how much stuff sort of rides on me in that sense. It'd be terrible, you know. Leadership has felt this as we've gone through the building project, because the building project has involved debt, it's involved finance raising, it's involved responsibility. And you go, hey, really see some benefits to moving upstairs. This will be great. But it also comes with this enormous thing. What if this group of elders, this group of council, are the ones who crash this ship? Wouldn't that be amazing? Somebody said no. Well, I mean, it would be amazing in the negative sense of that word. But don't think that that doesn't play on people. You know, you sit there with that level of responsibility, which is why you pray for your leaders. But notice also, he says this, do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses. Why would an elder be more prone to receive an accusation than anybody else? Why would Paul take a moment in a book like this to say, watch out? Well, here's the reason. Is because not only does leadership come with a greater degree of responsibility, it also comes with a greater degree of danger of accusation, both real and false. And Christian, I know you know this, but you need to familiarize yourself with the truth of it. The truth of it is, people will lie. And they lie about leaders all the time. People make up stuff. They just do. You know, the rule has always been, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. If somebody were to come up with an accusation against Pastor Doran or Elder Dave or Elder Zach or whatever, well, where there's smoke, there must be fire, unless it's a lie. And so Paul says, look, do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses. Don't even entertain the thought of it on the basis of one person, because one person can say anything and is also liable to say anything. If politics has taught us anything in the last 30 years, is that anybody can say anything even if it's not true. People just say stuff. And I know you think on some basis, well, how could I can't imagine I would ever do that. Well, guess what? People do. They routinely make stuff up and purport it as truth. And so understand, at some point in the life of this church, at some point, some elder is going to be accused of a thing. Some pastor is going to be accused of a thing. And how you handle that is very, very important. Absolutely crystal clear important. That we have to be very careful to make sure that a thing said is a thing that's true. Because, folks, people will make up stuff about this church and make up stuff about your leadership just to destroy the place. They just will. Now, does that mean that I'm immune to flushing the ship? Absolutely not. I could fall into sin. I could use the wrong words. I could deal with somebody wrongly and destroy the place. That could happen. But also understand, we are surrounded in a community with people who may not have our best interest at heart. And some of those people will lie. They'll lie about your deacons. They'll lie about your elders. They'll lie about your Sunday school teachers. People do. They just make stuff up. And so Paul says, don't entertain an accusation against a leader, an elder, except on the basis of two or three witnesses, because the fact is, people will lie. It's just true. That's the way it works. Now, when an elder does in fact sin, those who do sin, those who are verifiably in sin, you rebuke in the presence of all so that the rest also may be fearful of sinning. And so people do differ. Well, is this you correct the sin of a leader in front of leadership, or do you correct the sin of a leader in front of a congregation? I tend to think in front of a congregation. Notice that not all sin will bring about the removal of a pastor, but it should bring about the correction of a pastor. When I am sinning, notice here, sin, not weirdness. Man, I am so glad Paul doesn't say, hey, if you have a pastor who's weird, you correct him in front of everybody. Right, I'd have to quit. But also understand that. Folks, I've watched this my whole life, and I try to get a little bit more gracious every year. As I've worked in churches and worked inside churches with uniquely with elder boards, right? I had one stint with the Southern Baptist Church years ago in which a deacon board functioned as an elder board. But really, leadership was made up of a group of people. What I have found, and I think this passage really deals with that, is that some people don't like elders not because of sin, or there's one particular person in leadership that they dislike, or there's one particular pastor that they just don't care for, and it's not because of sin, it's because of something personal. I just don't like that person. Folks, don't be that way. Don't be that way. Now, I know you all like me, because I'm so likable, right? But there may be somebody on the leadership team that you go, you know, I just don't like the look of that person. I don't like their face. I don't like the way that they, I don't like their voice. I don't like the way they talk to me. I just don't like them, right? That happens. And I could ask you for a reason. Hey, have you ever come across somebody that you just didn't like for no good reason? Most hands would go up. Most hands would go up. Sometimes we just come across a person that we don't like, and we can't necessarily identify why. Be very careful with those feelings. And you know, I have noticed through the years, people sort of slowly or mechanically working against somebody in a church leadership or a pastor or an elder for no good reason, then there was something about them they just didn't like. Separate out those issues. It is not necessary for you to be the biggest fan of everybody in leadership. It just isn't. You know, the fact is, I don't work with anybody I don't like. I've been very fortunate. Everybody I've ever had to work with on a leadership team or an elder board or a deacon board, I like them all. I just do. I'm easy to please that way. But I can understand why there'd be an elder that you didn't like, or why there'd be a deacon who just rubs you the wrong way. Don't let those personal issues get in the way of you dealing with your brother or sister in the Lord rightly. Don't. And in fact, that little area, that little dislike, and in fact, any dislike that you have of a person can be a foothold of the devil in your life. The devil loves to separate people over issues that don't matter. He loves to cause division where there really isn't any. He loves to highlight someone's quirkiness, their weirdness, their strangeness, and for you to turn that into a sin issue. Don't let yourself do that. These are the basis very often of false accusations in church history. In fact, sometimes it works the other way. I've seen pastors who were targeted and hated by either a male or a female in the church because secretly they were in love with them. It's a thing, one of those dynamics of working with people, right? I've seen guys who struggled with homosexuality had feelings towards their pastor and grow to hate that pastor because of it. I've seen women who fell in love with their pastor and as a result they grew to hate him because of that struggle there in the flesh. You got to watch those kinds of things. These are the real dynamics of the way people operate. Watch out and live honest with that. Because the devil loves to highlight those differences and cause division where there isn't any. Now, those pastors who you have to correct, not all pastors get removed from the job, right? We had a pastor when I was in high school. The church voted in a new pastor. It wasn't a pastor I particularly cared for, but you try not to let those personal issues get in the way. And so he was on the job for a few months, and he got caught drinking and driving, right? So this is an evangelical Bible church. The pastor gets caught drinking and driving, and you go, okay, got to do something about that. Seems like it. Some of you out there are like, well, why would you do anything about that? And so the question is, what do? Do you remove him from the office, or do you work with him in the office? Churches really have to deal with that, because remember, this is a fragile little world. How do you deal with a pastor in grace? How do you bring correction? And then also, how do you protect the church? In the internal dynamics of the way a church works, you may have to struggle and wrestle with those things. There's an entire wing of church reconciliation ministry that works with only these issues. How do you deal with impropriety or struggle or sin among your elder board, your pastorate? And this is why, folks, I live in fear that I not be the cause of this little ship to flood. I want it to be somebody else on the elder board, not me. All right. And so Paul then turns. He says, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus and His chosen angels to maintain these principles without bias, doing nothing in a spirit of partiality. Do not lay hands upon anyone too hastily and thereby share responsibility for the sins of others. Keep yourselves free of sin. Notice these two things go together. Do nothing out of partiality. And don't you know this is the big bugaboo of working in church work through the years? Well, this pastor is excessively productive. This pastor is excessively successful. This pastor is really robust in his ministry. So, yeah, he has these issues, but we're going to keep those secret. We're going to cover those up. Folks, this sort of partiality in leadership can't exist. There is a sense, and there must be a sense, of even-handedness. When you're talking about the internal workings of a church, that you make sure that simply you work even-handed across the board, that somebody doesn't get away with something simply because they're the pastor's best friend, or a pastor gets away with something because he's the key to the church. I've seen churches do this. There's a church not all that far from here where the pastor had an affair with a woman in the church, and the entire staff and leadership team covered it up for years because that pastor was excessively productive and successful. He built a robust ministry that did really well, and so everybody got in on the lie. That can't happen ever. That can't happen ever. And actually, that was in a different county, so don't think, oh, I know who that place is. I figured it out. No. The other is, Paul puts a proviso here, and it's a principle. Do not lay hands upon, probably what he has in mind here is ordination. Do not ordain or lay hands upon anyone too hastily and thereby share responsibility for the sins of others. Be careful as you approach a person to figure out, is this person cut out for leadership? Is this person cut out for the ministry that God's called them to? I want you to understand, if you find yourself a deacon today, if you find yourself an elder today, if you find yourself a Sunday school teacher today, it's because somebody evaluated you first to figure out, is this a person that we should take a chance on trusting with this? That is a really important point. Because who leadership ordains, they bear some responsibility for. So years ago, our associate pastor was ordained for the ministry by the leadership team here at the church. That was not done simply because we're a good old boy and he's a good old boy church. You know, that's not the way it works. But rather, there was a circumspect evaluation. Has God led and called this person to ministry? And then he's placed through a series of examinations, placed in ministries to see how he might perform, placed to see if God's going to bless his work. And that gives you such incredible amount of confidence. That's why when Paul says, if somebody wishes to be an elder, they desire a good thing. And then I hope that you aspire to take responsibility for God's church. I hope that you sit here and you say, you know what? Someday I hope to be in this pastorate. I hope to be in this deaconate. I hope to be a Sunday school teacher or somebody who's given the role or the responsibility of the spiritual growth of other people. I hope you aspire to that. Understand, though, it comes with incredible responsibility, but also incredible examination. We have to be careful as a church who we aspire. Folks, getting a sense, this is the internal plumbing of how a church works. Because if you don't get this right, you can flood the ship in short order. You can destroy this fragile little world of ours by picking people who simply, well, he's a good business guy. Or, you know, he's a good guy. He's got his issues. But, so you want to be very careful. And it also, as a congregant here, it should give you a tremendous amount of confidence that at least there's somebody at the helm looking to see who our leaders ought to be. But also responsibility is this. Make sure you pray for your leaders. Make sure you, as an ordinary congregant, as somebody not in the pastorate yet, as somebody not in the deaconate yet, that you pray for every deacon and every Sunday school teacher and every pastor, that we might walk with the Lord as we ought, might be able to lead as we ought, might develop wisdom as we ought. These people have a tremendous responsibility. Paul then says, look, no longer drink water exclusively, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. The sins of some men are quite evident, going before them to judgment. For others, their sins follow after. Likewise, also the deeds that are good are quite evident, and those which are otherwise cannot be concealed. Now, Paul throws in a statement here about the drinking of wine. And it's just an interesting thing, because I'm sure at this point in church history, they're already asking the question, what should be the church's relationship, or specifically, church leadership's relationship with alcohol? What should be their responsibility? Jesus talks about this. You know, John came neither eating or drinking. I came eating and drinking. You call me a drunkard and a glutton. Is that you have to be careful in the association of alcohol with your leadership. So for this church, we've just made a practical decision. We abstain from alcohol, just simply so there's no question. Paul here prescribes it for Timothy, but understanding, look, people are going to probably question this and look at it. What do you want to do with it? And so because water is safe to drink, because of the association of the American culture with alcohol, we've just chosen to stay away from it in leadership, which is probably a prudent and wise decision, but it's certainly not scripturally mandated. It's just a thing that we're careful with. But notice, verse 24, he really deals with the meat of it. The sins of some men are quite evident, going before them to judgment. For others, their sins follow after. Likewise, also the deeds that are good are quite evident, and those which are otherwise cannot be concealed. Here's the point. If you're good at hiding your sin, it will take you longer to be known. If you're bad at hiding your sin, people will figure it out very quickly. Which would you rather be? It's a good question. You know, when I come across people who are good liars, you have to admire the skill of a good liar. You know, people who can weave a tale together that's believable, that's amazing. You know, it's quite the skill. Well, yeah, but it's an evil. Oh, wait, there is that. There is that. But the people who aren't good at hiding their sin, their lives are sort of out. Well, you have to, at that point, maybe criticize them for being incompetent, right? People who aren't good at hiding their sin. Well, Paul says, look, either way, whether a person's easy to figure out or hard to figure out, eventually who they are comes to the surface. This is one of the reasons that Paul recommends don't make a person an elder or a deacon too hastily. Rather, give them limited responsibility. Also, examine them for a while. Make sure they're not a new believer. Because it takes a while for someone's mettle to show. It takes a while for someone's character to rise to the surface. That someone who has a drink once in a while, as the passage would seem to indicate, that person may be a drunk or they may be a person in regulation. It takes a while to figure that person out. Well, it's that way in every other thing in your life. That a person, who they are, only gets revealed under examination and over time. Also in the operation of responsibility. Be careful who you give responsibility to, lest they prove themselves unequal to it. This is why make those who are deacons people who have a good regulation over their own home. Those who are elders, people who are not pugnacious or prone to fight. Look for people who exhibit God's character so that they may become trustworthy stewards of God's people. Christian, this is the internal plumbing of the Christian church. This is the way it works. And it's very important that we get this right, because Jesus has made this very clear. You and I are not a church that exists in peace. We exist in warfare. Our enemy, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He seeks to discourage God's people. He seeks to bring down God's church. He seeks to destroy everything good. Don't ever forget that. In a few weeks, we're going to have a church meeting. It's an annual meeting where we approve our leaders for the new year, where we look for deacons, we look for elders, we look for people who hold key positions in the church. Don't consider these things simply autopilot decisions. Don't consider them only rubber stamp decisions. These are things that you really must contemplate and pray over, because these are people who, in essence, hold the purse strings as well as the doctrinal strings of God's church here. Each one of you ought to be at that meeting, not only because there are issues of serious weight that we have to discuss, but also there are issues of serious import for the future. For you who are members of the church, you're called to take responsibility for it. One of the reasons you came into membership was that you might take a voting responsibility for the direction of the church. If you come here, you consider yourself part of our church family, you should come simply for no other reason than the observation of a thing that is good, but also that you might pray informatively towards God's business here. Take the time, and especially as we turn into a new year, look for how God might use you more, how God might open doors for you in ministry that have previously been closed. Look to take greater responsibility. If you're a part of the crowd here where you come in and you consider yourself a person who comes to church here, look to be a part of the committed group. If you're part of the committed group, you're here all the time, you love this place, you consider it your home, look to be a member of the core who takes responsibility for God's church. Because folks, remember, this is not some organization that exists in peace for the sake of a community of people to make life better. We are a group of people at war with darkness and embattled against the devil. We fight falsehood of every sort and every high thought that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And part of peace, a member of the combat of that, is actually simple plumbing of how the church works. Don't undervalue it. Let's go to pray. Father, we do thank you for the day. We thank you for your word. We thank you for your group of people who gather every Sunday that we might worship, be encouraged, be fueled with knowledge, that we might work out our faith a little better each and every day. And we thank you for this new year. We thank you for all the success of the past, and we look forward to what you would have for us for the future, that we might walk with you as we ought, might walk with you better than we did last year, and might measure our faith year by year as one of growing trajectory rather than simply static stagnation. And it's in your name we pray. Amen.
Please stand and sing with us.